If you want to just start by introducing yourself and just explain the reason for your visit to Montreal.
Hi, I'm Nimo Bassi. I came in from Nigeria to Montreal. I'm an environmental justice activist. Worked several years with Environmental Rights Action and now with Oil Watch International, a new organization called the Health of Mother Earth Foundation, as well as Friends of the Earth International. So I work with quite a number of environmental justice organizations, but we do one thing, fighting for justice, fighting for equity, and fighting for the transformation of our society in a way that respects the environment. I'm here in Canada in solidarity with Alternatives and all those who are coming to the Festival of Alternatives so that we can really look at the critical issues that are confronting us as global citizens and that threatens the future of the planet and the people.
Could you tell me maybe, because you were specifically with organizations that identify with climate justice and fighting these different extraction methods from a more holistic social perspective. Could you tell me a bit about that?
Yes. For years now, many organizations and movements have been working to push the concept of dealing with the climate challenge fundamentally to our policymakers from various nations in the world. Because whenever they meet to talk about global warming, rather than looking at the fundamental cause of the problem, they look at the business opportunities that climate change provides. So environmental justice organizations like Friends of the Earth International, which is the biggest federation of grassroots groups working on this issue, a mass movement like La Via Campesina, which is the biggest global peasant farmers organization, all saying, look, the climate challenge pushes the adverse effects of global warming on people who did not cause the problem. Because climate change is largely man-made, and because we insist on burning fossil fuels. And so the high consumption nations, the rich industrialized nations, have historically pumped millions of tons of greenhouse gases to the atmosphere, putting the whole world in danger at the moment. And now we are literally at the precipice. And a conservative body like the World Bank warned late last year that unless 80% of the known fossil fuel reserves are left untouched, then we will have a good chance of avoiding catastrophic global warming. Now, what is the response of the world? The global environmental justice movement are saying at this time, look, the solution is not digging further into the fossil fuel paradigm. It's not saying, oh, fossil fuels are not going to get exhausted, even though we know it's non-renewable. We can go into more extreme ways of extracting crude oil. We can go to tar sands. We can change coal to liquid. You can frack. You can do this or that. And so for many years to come, we're still going to have this resource. You know, if it is known that we should not expand what is already known, if we're going to have a planet to live in at the same level as, I mean, comparable to what we have now, then it really doesn't make sense at all to look for more, to increase that reserve and then to exploit it. It means we don't recognize that we are living in dangerous times.
When you say that we're not looking at the full reserve, we often talk about the fact that we have this unlimited pool of resources and Africa is far, far richer than people like us to know. So could you talk about maybe the ways that we could deconstruct that myth of Africa having this infinite wealth of resources that is accessible to everyone?
Yeah, certainly Africa has been seen as the resource storehouse of the global north for hundreds of years. This is what triggered colonialism. It's what triggered slavery. It's what is triggering the land grabs that are going on at the moment. And, you know, it's a myth that we can trash a continent endlessly and then at the same time pretend to be doing good to it. Certainly, the the way and manner in which resources in Africa have been taken leave a lot to be desired, not the least being the fact that the resource extraction has exacted very severe environmental cost on the continent. Because if you just consider the fact that many of the conflicts, armed conflicts on the continent, are resource conflicts, and these conflicts are not being fought just for political reasons. They are fought to clear up the way for the exploiters to extract the resources, creating more harm, impoverishing the continent, damaging it, the entire social fabric of the continent. So over the years, we've seen this pattern. The other factor is that it's not just the act of extracting resource as though they were endless and limitless that is harmful. The other factor that is very serious, has serious implication, is the factor of the economic policies of the continent being largely driven from outside the continent, especially by international financial institutions like the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank and similar clubs and organizations. And when we look at the policy directions, especially in terms of how the economy should be run and how the economy should be opened up and why resources must be exported so as to end foreign exchange, to service debt, or to import foreign goods, these policies simply make Africa dumping ground for many things and damages internally generated ideas and internal productivity. And so Africa is doubly trashed by external forces. And all this weakens the capacity of the continent also to respond to global warming. Because when global warming meets vulnerability, when it meets situation where the infrastructures are not resilient enough, you're having absolute calamity. And this is why also, apart from the fact that naturally, Africa has a higher impact in terms of temperature increase than any other region in the world. So you find that the stacks, everything is stacked against the continent. And so the best that can be done for us is for us to stand with global organizations and citizens around the world who are not certainly in support of what the politicians are doing or what the transnational corporation is doing, for us to build global solidarity against the forces that are destroying the lives of peoples, not just in Africa, but all over the world, and so as to build solidarity that would help us point in the right direction that we must go.
What are some of the strategies or tactics that groups and like different grassroots organizations are using in Africa? And or maybe if you want to speak more specifically to an example, such as like groups in the Niger Delta that you've worked with.
Well, I think the basic African strategy has always been to have conversations. And this is what is not happening. I know in Nigeria, by the time I was as I was a part of the human rights movement in the country in the military era, I found that what most communities were demanding from transnational oil companies and the military government was always, let's sit down and talk. They keep saying the same thing. Let's sit down and talk. Let's have a conversation about how you are behaving in our environment, about the harm you are doing, about when you are going to clean up, about when we're going to see some benefit. And whenever people ask for a conversation, the response was repression. And so till tomorrow, conversation is still the best way out of all these challenges. Because if you go to a community and say, okay, I'm going to extract oil, I will spill oil here, maybe once every week or once every month, I'm going to pollute your water, then the community people could say, okay, we like that. Or they could say, no, we don't want that. And then you have to get to agreement with them. Either if they accept the polluting activities, fine. If they don't accept it, then you move somewhere else. But there's no level of engagement at all that can be construed to mean that there's a kind of consent from the communities. But this is not only happening in Africa. I've seen it clearly in Ireland, where Shell is building a gas pipeline as well as a gas refinery. If a visit to some communities in Mayo County in Ireland, some of the communities have built, they have posters on every electric pole. No consent, written all over the community, showing that they don't consent to the development that is going on there. But the development is going on, irrespective of the fact that the people don't give consent to this. This is what really generates conflicts around the world with regard to extractive and corporations and those who refine their products. They don't respect people. They don't respect the environment. So the organizing pattern that is going on is still people coming together to force open possibilities of conversations. When this fails, people are going to conversations in the law courts through litigation and, of course, other direct actions. One of the things we do, particularly in the Delta and across some other places in Africa, especially with regard to oil extraction, is the building of community networks where community people learn, train, and share information and knowledge on environmental monitoring and reporting so that no harm is inflicted on their communities without somebody knowing about it. Because this is the least they can do to tell the world about what's going on. So they are continuously monitoring activities of the companies and reporting environmental misbehavior in their communities, like oil spills and other waste dumps and other issues. And I think on one level, we all need to be environmental monitors around the world to watch very closely what is going on. Anything that is abnormal in society must be reporting and resisted. And then, of course, also we have to force these corporations or the great those who do major harm, who inflict major harm on the environment, to sit down and tell us why we should allow them to carry on with impunity. One other level of organizing in future must be, which is going on right now, is to fight for globally recognized legislations. For example, Declaration of the Universal Rights of Mother Earth, of nature, so that anybody who harms nature anywhere in the world could be held accountable. For example, we have a Universal Declaration of the Rights of Mother Earth, and the tar sands companies in Canada creating so much damage, they could be held accountable anywhere in the world, because we have one planet, we have one environment. You cannot harm the environment in one place and go to hide somewhere else in comfort. So if we have this kind of universal jurisdiction, it will help the world, the citizens of the world, to hold corporations and individuals accountable, no matter where they committed any kind of crime, environmental crime. So we need to have ecocide as a recognized crime, punishable at the same level or even higher as genocide or other acts against humanity and against the planet in this case.
And how is it that there is such a lack then of regulation in certain countries in Africa, which is actually very similar to the situation in Canada for a lot of like mining companies, especially to come and extract? So how is it that companies are allowed to get away with so much more?
This is the question that we have to ask ourselves, because these corporations are more or less above the law. And then on one hand, they will claim to be citizens and have the rights as citizens. At the other hand, they cannot be held accountable as citizens are held accountable when they commit crimes. This is why we really need very clear jurisdiction, that very clear laws with which we can hold them accountable, hold the directors of these companies accountable as individuals, since we cannot put a company in jail, for example. So we can hold the director, put them in jail if they damage the environment in a way that is irredeemable or unacceptable. But I think generally that corporations are able to get away with murder right now because we've got the neoliberal paradigm, neoliberal logic being elevated to a global creed, global religion, where it's believed that capital is the god that must be worshipped, and transnational corporations are the high priests in the temples of capital. So clearly, this is the logic that has locked the world to the very dangerous path that is not leading to anything good. Anything goes, more or less, as long as it's called investment, it's called growth, it's called development. Everybody, the policymakers are glad to do the bidding of transnational corporations. Actually, the one way I like to see governments in relationship with transnational corporations or big company is that governments are the shoeshine boys of corporations. So because the corporations, to a large extent, influence who becomes the head of which government through campaign supports, through advertisements, and through all kinds of means. And they have the ears. Once they're elected into office, most of officials listen more to corporations than they listen to their constituencies or constituents who voted them into office. So this is a big political challenge for all nations, every nation, not one nation excluded. We have to regain our sovereignty as people, that once we vote in people into power, we've not ceded our sovereignty to them. They are there to represent us, and when not to represent corporations, and when they cease to represent us, we should call them to account and recall them from those offices. So it must be a global political project, not tied to any political party, but really looking at a way that we can bring some sense into what is going on, because it's absolutely ridiculous that corporations would get away with anything they want. Special, there's always this, we have tax havens allowed. People allow offshore locations where corporations can hide away their revenue without, at the same time, impoverishing the same structures that gave them this leeway. So the whole thing is absurd.
Yeah, it's such a vicious cycle. And even just the discussion around how to, demystify a lot of these proposed projects and the ways that the government is, where, is the spokesperson on behalf of these corporations, is always a barrier. So I wonder too, on a local level, how do you start working around those barriers of disinformation? Even just talking about the basic science of what kind of chemicals are used versus others in certain projects, which are often used between competitors to try to sell a project to a community. Based on the fact that we just have such a restricted knowledge, we're not really looking at the fact that chemical change or no chemical change or fracking or other kinds of extractions, it's all the same thing. Mm. And so how do we work around that disinformation barrier when it's easy to sell more jobs to local communities or sell more economic opportunities that way?
It's a big challenge. And again, it your question hits at the root of the fact that the public sector is governed by hypocrisy and the deliberate falsehood most of the time when it comes to projects. Now, pipelines and other such projects are presented as things that will create jobs, but pipelines don't create so much jobs. They don't. Once you've laid the pipeline, the product is going through the pipes. Nobody's going to be carrying them on their shoulders or sitting down there to watch what is going on beneath inside the pipelines. But I think also that a critical thing is that although there's most places we have a requirement for environmental impact assessment, that law, if it is ever strictly adhered to anywhere in the world, would help defend the environment to a large extent. Because one of the requirements of environmental impact assessment is that there must be involvement of those who will be impacted by the project. So it requires public consultations, public discussions. It requires presentation of the report in a language that's accessible to everybody. And there should be sufficient time for people to read the report and make comments. But most times, find environmental impact assessments, reports are just perform three things written for policymakers or regulators to say, okay, to tick it off as one of the things that have been done that's required for the project. Nobody's really preparing them specifically for special locations or even studying the reports. Also because there's this regime of revolving chairs between policymakers and industry players. A few years in industry, a few years in government, and they go back to industry and they keep revolving. It's the same set of people. So they have this old boys mentality that they belong to a fraternity or to a club. And so nobody looks at anything. We saw a very clear example when there was the oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico in 2010, when the environmental impact assessment were analyzed. They found that some of the marine life species that BP said they would protect if there's an accident don't exist in the Gulf of Mexico. So clearly that report was a cut and paste document from somewhere else. So if that could happen in the United States, I think it's happening in most other places around the world. So we're just paying lip service to regulations that are not being enforced. And so you can have people proposing any kind of making jokes over people's life. You're going to reverse the pipeline, do this or that, move somewhere. All these are just things they think is flying over everybody's head and nobody really cares what is going on. And they tell you we're not going to see it until the spill erupts. Like I just heard about an oil spill that occurred here about 1st of June. It's only 2 days or so ago that it's been made public. So you have this kind of incidents happening. And as far as the majority of the people don't know about it, then okay, it's well and good. I think it's the kind of nonsense that needs to be exposed and campaigned against. And our politicians have to know that environmental pollution does not respect political ideology or divide. This issue about life.
One thing I'm curious to know is what are different tactics that are more direct actions that are out there right now? Like there was MEND that was doing a lot of direct actions. Do they even exist anymore? And like, were there other groups that were taking an active stance right now in just going straight up and trying to address those different projects?
You know, we may not have as many direct actions as we would like to see. But I think whenever there's a public manifestation of dissent or uprising or occupy or any kind of situation where people mobilize to oppose public policies, if you dissect all the oppositions, you find that people are opposing. They're opposed to many of these environmentally harmful activities at the same time. So we're having a coming together of social forces that may not really disaggregate themselves as being economic, or talk about economic issues, social issues, political issues, environmental issues. All these are integrated. So when people complain about the system, it's the entire system, because what we're confronted with is a systemic problem. The system where anything goes, a system where the rich can walk on the back of the poor, a system where the more powerful you are, the more you can carry out the live in impunity and do whatever you like. The more money you have, the stronger you are as a corporation, the more power you have to live above the law. So this is a system, the logic of capital, that is really harmful and which is what may not sometimes be confronted directly. But obviously the right way to confront this, we're seeing them, we're seeing the issue. I don't know more, for example, in Canada, that was a very imaginative way. I think that was direct action, even though they may not block a pipeline, but people to say, well, we're going to speak up, we're going to stand up, we're going to bang our pots or whatever, and we're going to refuse to eat food and go fasting for some weeks. I mean, these are very direct ways of expressing disgust at a system that doesn't respect humanity anymore.
In that line of thought, are there ways that you would propose then that different strategies be used, similar tactics where we can, you know, really bring cohesive cooperation to and solidarity to those movements?
Yeah. The critical thing we need to do around the world is for people to open their eyes at what is going on around them and say no to anything that is destructive. I say no to anything that is harmful to us today or has the potential of being harmful to our children. Once we come to the point, if we can aggregate all the things that we have commonality on and resist and refuse, then we can have a multitude of solutions and alternatives. Because to every problem, there are many alternatives. And this is the beauty of global movement for environmental justice. One argument is the same. We don't want our environment to be damaged. But the solutions are millions, according to specific context. And this is how we need to really find ways of sharing our stories, building our narratives, exchanging ideas, building solidarity, which is one reason why I'm here, to hear the stories here, get to know more about what's going on here, and also tell what I know and what I've experienced, to share my pains and my grief, and also my triumphs and hopes, and also hopefully give somebody hope also, hopefully.
Lots of hope for sure.
Yes, yes.
And that's one word we don't hear enough, right? It's so easy to also to just feel more disempowered by the larger picture of everything that is wrong and messed up. But let's talk about some triumphs. Let's talk about some hopeful things that have happened maybe of late that you've experienced or participated in.
Yeah, I think that's important, because sometimes when we just talk about all these impacts and negative things, then of course the corporations and those who are harming us would like us to keep talking about that. And they've got that has a very paralyzing effect. People say, okay, now these things are so bad, there's nothing we can do about it. And then people just go away, say, okay, oh, too bad. They go to their corners and cry and fold their hands. And then those who are riding on our back, the vampires will sink their teeth deeper into our veins and suck our blood. But you know, there are small but significant victories and things to crow about and to celebrate. For example, when poor fishermen in Nigeria challenged Shell in court in the Netherlands, and 4 cases and 1 victory. I mean, that is significant. They didn't win all the cases, but at least they won one. We showed that the parent body can be held to account for what the subsidiary does far away in the backwaters of Nigeria. So I think that judgment that came in the Hague at the end of January 2013 was a significant point for celebration and opened up the way of bringing other challenges to these huge monsters who don't really care about our peoples.
Can you talk a bit about how that developed, or how did these fishermen organize?
Right from 2004, 2006, about those times there were some, of course we have pollution, oil spills every day in Nigeria, in the Delta. Shell alone admitted to 200 oil spills in 2012, out of which they admitted 50 has been due to equipment failure or their mistakes. I mean, for one oil company to admit to 50 oil spills in 1 year in one country, that tells you a big story. So there were some oil spills in the 2004 and thereabout were in three communities, 4 oil spills in 3 communities in the Niger Delta. One is called Oruma, another one Goi in Ogoni, and then another place closer to where I come from, at the called Adaodo. And these were spills that were very obvious to everybody. The one at the called Adaodo was an old oil well, a capped oil well that is not producing, it drilled and then capped and kept. It just erupted and for many months it was spilling oil in the farmland. You could farm a lake of crude oil. And the national TV, everybody was going to see an ongoing oil spill before Shell eventually went to stop the spill. And so the case was taken to the court in the Netherlands, asking that the court should hold Shell liable for the damage done and to demand that they should clean up the mess and also, of course, compensate the farmers. And then another case was in a case where the pipeline that is buried six feet in the ground sprung a leak at the lower portion of the pipeline. And then eventually Shell claimed that it was done by sabotage. But if somebody wants to sabotage a pipeline, you don't dig 6 feet down, then go to the underside of the pipeline. You could blow it off from the top. But of course, the court agreed that this was sabotage. Then another case is in the Ogoni land where a big oil spill was followed by fire that actually destroyed the river system in the community, burnt fish ponds and buildings, and nobody lives in that community anymore till now. So that case also went to the Hague, and the judge held Shell not liable for that, and then also held Shell not liable for the pipe that was buried 6 feet in the ground, and only held them liable for the one that the wellhead in the farm erupted. So the communities went to court, and the judicial system in the Netherlands is quite different from what we see elsewhere, because there were no many sessions of the, it was just about changing documents. Then I think 1 or 2 public court hearings, and then they set the date for judgment. And the judgment was given on the 30th of January, 2013. And the fishermen, those who lost the case, have filed an appeal against the judgment, because it's not very clear how those cases were ruled against.
Yeah, I just have one more question. You've sort of answered this, but maybe just talk about what is the current situation in the Niger Delta, which is one of the most heavily impacted areas in your country.
It's heavily.
So some of the states of the struggle is going on there right now.
You know, recently I was with comrades from Oil Watch Africa, and we had our meeting in South Africa. And we went on a field trip to some old coal mining communities in Midrand, South Africa, Witbank, South Africa. And we got to a location where we saw, you know, fires burning in abandoned coal mines. You could see the heat wave then you can smell the sulfur and everything. It's like you can smell evil in the atmosphere. You remember the smell of sulfur? Yeah. And so we're told that some of these fires have been burning for over 50 years, almost as long as the gas flares of Nigeria. And then the land would just open sometimes and swallow people, swallow buildings. They have sinkholes all over the place. And people, poor people are still living near these areas. Well, I mentioned this because there was a debate between some friends from that area and some friends from Nigeria. The debate was which area is more polluted, Witbank or the Niger Delta. And I told them, look, this is not a good debate at all. We don't want a record about where we, whether where we come from is the most polluted place in the world. But it just shows the depth of the depravity of what corporations have done because of money to environments where they don't really have a stake except for the money they're getting from it. So the struggle, yes, in the Niger Delta, the situation is still government. A few things being done, for example, maybe need a few more infrastructure being put in place. But what we're really concerned about is the quality of the environment. I think because of the active watchdog role of communities, pollution incidents are more difficult to hide. So the corporations are reporting things by themselves and also responding a bit quicker than before in terms of stopping spills, but not in cleanup. So that's still a big hurdle. It's a big challenge about the quality of cleanup that is done. Now they depend on certification by responsible regulatory agencies that they've cleaned up the spill. But if you go to actually look at where they've certified cleaned, you would see clearly that this is not the case. Yeah, so the challenges are still there. You heard about the United Nations Environment Programme report on the assessment of Ogoni environment. That report was issued in August 2011. And it clearly showed that we have an environmental emergency on our hands in Ogoniland. Now, the best response so far has been signboards telling people not to either go into the environment or go to farmland or go to the water bodies. But where are they going to go? Well, this is where they live there. You tell them don't live here or don't go there, you have to tell them where else to go. So 2 years now of, I would say, largely inaction, and people are still living in that desperate situation. So we have the challenge of gas flares are still going on, and gas flaring is very harmful, and of course, continuous oil spills from the rotten facilities of these corporations. So it's a big task, and the corporations are moving further and further offshore, because what's going offshore is a different ballgame entirely. There's nobody watching over what is going on there, and I'm sure the pollution there must be of a unique level. And then, of course, the oil companies, some of them are selling off some of their oil fields onshore to smaller corporations and to local firms who are very happy to buy up this. But I think it's a way of selling off liability, which we don't really accept. You can't sell off your liability. If you polluted the land historically, you must be held accountable for what you've done. But this I've not checked the agreement, but sometimes they try to have a fine line where they will absorb themselves of historical responsibility. On land, they shared it there in the refinery in Curacao, in the Caribbean. You know, they put a clause that they would not be held responsible for whatever they had done in that territory. So it's not above them, it's not beyond them to do this, even in the fields that they're selling. But one thing we've noted, Nigerian government is getting worried about this trend of Shell, Chevron, the rest, selling off their fields onshore, as they see it as a mark of divestment. I think what the corporations are doing really, they're trying to avoid responsibility while not losing anything in terms of profit. Because they may sell off the field, but they're not selling off the pipelines. And so those who buy the fields will have to pay rent to use the facilities that this corporation put in place. And so they are very clever. They're still there. They're just changing the pattern of the business they're doing so that you cannot see them to blame. You've seen some of your current blame, they're laughing all the way to the bank. I think they must be liable for at least for the historical pollution. And of course, they have the pipeline, they have the reliable for whatever happens from those pipelines. But as far as I'm concerned, they're selling the oil field, which is far below the earth. What happens above the earth, as long as the facilities still belongs to them, they must be held accountable for that.
I wonder if that's going to be a tactic then to attract them, more companies to be involved as their facade for those kinds of projects.
That could be. It could also be a strategy to force the hands of government to lessen the regulatory requirements, so that they could do as they will to get a better deal, more so to speak.
Yeah, and a lot of the further off offshore drilling too, is that also just a way of like
I think the offshore moving offshore again, there are two reasons, there are many reasons, but two of them would be that many of the onshore fields are depleting. They're not yielding as they used to, because they're getting old and aging. And offshore, these are new fields that would spot, to use their industry language, much young fields, they yield more. And then of course, they can do whatever they like and pollute without much oversight by local people. It's more dangerous because the further offshore they go, the more difficult room for them to handle accidents when they happen. The amount of money they're investing in research and in technology to go deeper into the high seas, they could invest half of that money in developing alternative energy. I'm sure there'll be many breakthroughs and things will get cheaper.
Is there anything else maybe you wanted to add about as a message to how right now we can really keep on connecting our struggles?
I think the threat to the global environment is where one organizing force, one organizing point that should bring advocates around the world together to, maybe not physically, but at least in terms of the struggles. Because we, as easy oil is getting exhausted, the dirty oil is being pursued everywhere around the world. And so there's going to be virtually, in Africa, there's no country that is not about extracting one form of fossil fuel or the other. So nobody can say we are not touched by this or we're not affected by this. So just as the corporations are going everywhere, we must come from everywhere. Keep the oil in the soil, the coal in the hole. This is the solution.